from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Louis Armstrong was one of the jazz greats, a consummate musician, and an appealing entertainer who rose from the humblest of neighborhoods in New Orleans to global fame. He was also a grinning, gracious ambassador to black music for white audiences in a way that embarrassed many black musicians during and after the civil rights era. It's a big, complicated story tackled in Satchmo at the Waldorf, playing at ACT's Geary Theater. We'll talk with actor John Douglas Thompson and playwright Terry Teachout in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny, who's on vacation. Today, we're talking about Louis Armstrong. The story starts at the end of Louis Armstrong's career in 1971 at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. Armstrong staggers into his dressing room and heads straight for an oxygen tank. And then the story of his life begins, how he got his first trumpet, how he got in trouble with gangsters, his complicated relationship with his longtime manager, Joe Glazer, what he thinks of his own musical legacy. We're talking about Satchmo at the Waldorf, playing at ACT's Geary Theater in San Francisco. And I've got with me in studio the star of this one-man show, John Douglas Thompson, Obie Award-winning actor. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
And also the playwright, Terry Teachout, who, by the way, is also the drama critic of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Terry, let me ask you the first question. You'd already written a book about Armstrong based in large part on tapes he recorded while he was still alive.
Yes.
Why did you feel the need to write a play?
Well, I didn't. There's a cliche about how all drama critics dream of writing a play, and it had never occurred to me to write a play. But my biography of Armstrong, Pops, came out in the fall of 2009. And I did all the things you do when a biography comes out. And when I got back home, I got an email from somebody whose name didn't ring a bell that said, I read your book. I liked it very much. I didn't know Armstrong, but I did know Joe Glazer, his manager, and you really convey him very clearly. He said, it strikes me that there's a play here. Have you thought of writing it or trying to get somebody to write it? And I had not ever thought of such a thing. And then something made me Google his name. He was a theatrical producer. He had actually worked on Jelly's Last Jam and on Elaine Stritch's one-woman show. And I thought to myself, well, he knows something. And so I sat down and started writing. And 4 days later, I had the rough draft of Satchmo at the Waldorf and was absolutely convinced that it couldn't be any good at all because it had come out so fast. And I spent the next year and a half fixing that. And here we are.
John, I mean, did you know that much about Armstrong? Were you a fan of his before this?
Everybody asked me this question. No, not really. I think I knew as much about Armstrong as many people know. Look, Hello, Dolly, What a Wonderful World. You know, if it wasn't for, like, Good Morning Vietnam and Robin Williams playing that as the DJ in that show, in that movie, that's kind of what brought it back for me. So I knew of Armstrong, but I have to admit, certainly, and I'd like to think I'm very partial to my generation, a lot of people of my age knew about Armstrong, but didn't really – he wasn't really the main person for them as far as jazz musician.
Right. You were a Miles man.
Yeah, I was a Miles man, a Coltrane man, Herbie Hancock. You know, when I first got introduced to jazz – oddly enough, it was like David Sanborn. Do you remember David Sanborn? Well,
yes,
still
I
around,
remember
right?
David Sanborn.
And I kind of loved him. And I remember someone said, "You listen to David?" I said, "Yeah, I love David Sanborn." I said, "That's all new agey jazz." And he said, "You should listen to John Coltrane." I said, "Who?" And then I started getting Coltrane. From Coltrane, I got into Miles Davis through the autobiography by Quincy Troupe. And that kind of started my whole jazz thing. And Armstrong wasn't included in that.
He was maybe your parents' generation or
yeah,
your grandparents' generation.
My parents, who are from Jamaica and came over to England, saw him twice in England.
And this is a very common pattern for that generation.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's one of the reasons behind wanting to do a play about Armstrong. One of the things that this play does is take this great, great historical figure from American history and music history and reintroduce him to people who don't know the giant that he is.
And that's how it happened for me. I was reintroduced to Armstrong through the research that was necessary to do the play. And through Terry's book and several other books that I read, I started to gain a deep sense of appreciation and love for Armstrong, for his commitment, for what he did, for the journey that he took in his life, and also the price that it cost him, in a sense, and how he achieved on such an incredible level.
John prepared for this like a scholar would. I was really quite startled. I mean, I had no idea that he'd get the shovel out and go to work that way. I was staggered and enormously impressed.
Well, thank God. I mean, like, I live in New York, so does Terry. And in New York and Queens, there is the Armstrong House. And there's also would you call it an artifact museum? Or
yeah. I mean, the house has been restored to its original condition.
Right.
And then the Armstrong Archives are at
museum.
Queens College, and that's where all the tapes are. That's where, you know, the band book, his trumpets, even handkerchiefs he used to use.
Letters,
it's an astonishing
everything.
And there's a lot in this show, a lot of little tidbits, things you may not have known about Armstrong before walking in the theater. Like,
yes.
I didn't realize he took offense to Louis, that he wanted to be Louis.
Yes, that's an important – well, here's how that happened. When I did my book tour for Pops, I always take questions. I love taking questions. And about the second question I would always get after I spoke was, why do you say Louis and not Louis? And so when I wrote the play, I thought, well, I know people are interested in this, so why don't I answer that in the play itself? And so the answer is that Armstrong was a dark-skinned black who grew up in an area, New Orleans, where there was a great deal of intra-racial prejudice on the part of Creoles, light-skinned blacks of French descent. And they looked down on dark-skinned blacks. And so that was the motive for his wanting to pronounce his way not in a French way. And I wrote a scene in the play which explains that to the audience and gives the actor a chance to kid on the square, as we say, to be funny but serious at the same time.
And what about Satchmo? Where does that come from?
Well, that's he had a big mouth and
satchel mouth.
He was known as a boy, and so he goes to England for the first time in 32 or 33, I forget which year, and he's met at the boat train by a British jazz journalist who has a very stiff upper lip accent. So he gets off the train. Guy sees him, runs up and says, "Oh, hello, Satchel Mouth," or something like that. And Armstrong hears this as Satchmo. And he loves it. He loves nicknames. He thinks this is the perfect nickname, puts it on his stationery, and then the world comes to use and love it.
Yeah, it's great. It's like Satchel and Mouth.
Yeah.
Satchmo.
Yeah. Isn't that nice?
And it's a nickname he chose.
He loved it.
Really important.
He loved it.
I was kind of surprised. I mean, you know, it's called Satchmo at the Waldorf, but in many ways this story is 40%, 50% about his manager, Joe Glazer. Over 40 years. They had a 40-year relationship. And he gets to talk through you, John, quite a bit over 90 minutes.
He steals the scene.
He steals a lot of
that
scenes.
That Joe Glazer.
Terry, why did you want him so intertwined in this piece?
Because I guessed that the dramatic engine of the play, if you used one actor, would be the idea of a black actor crossing a race line to suddenly embody a white Jewish mobbed up manager, someone with whom Armstrong had had a very complex and tempestuous personal relationship. It's as though Othello and Iago were being played by the same person. And I knew, I guessed that that would really be an irresistible challenge for
yeah,
an actor.
Yeah. And it is to actually play these two men. And because it crosses the racial barrier, makes it very exciting. And it's also a conceit within the context of the show, of course, but also you get to see the closeness and the complexity of that relationship by having it come through one actor. And they're so diverse in their natures. Armstrong's obviously much older at a different point of his life, and Glazer is a little bit younger and being played at a different point in his life. And they're very different in their posture, the way they move through a room, the way they speak, the way they hold their bodies. So it was
and
really challenging as an actor.
So fluidly, yeah, to snap do, between yeah. the two. And right. yeah. there's a little change of lighting and set design, but really it's all coming through your body
yeah.
and your mind. I'm wondering, you know, maybe this is like a fan question, right? But how do you switch so quickly between the two?
I'd like to know that myself.
I can't give away secrets. No, you know, I will say this much, that we worked on it. When I started working on this play with Terry and with Gordon Edelstein, the director, we really worked on that aspect of the play and how to do it. Could we do it slower? Would we add things to a character, or just basically make it very raw and just the actor making the switches? And then it just became my job to technically to do them as best as possible. But also I feel that Terry's words and the way in which I do the transitions and when they happen all kind of flow together. So in one sense, it is very difficult. But in another sense, it makes sense to do it the way in
right.
which we're doing
the
it.
The transitions have dramatic point. It's not mm. just alternation. They flow out of each other. Sometimes in the next speech, Glazer will contradict something that Armstrong has just told us, or he'll confirm it.
It's like they're arguing from within you.
Yes, yeah.
It doesn't
that's right.
look
yeah.
like you're schizophrenic.
No.
You know,
no,
you're really
I feel
switching.
It,
yeah.
I feel schizophrenic.
And I wrote a couple of scenes, and I won't say what they are because I want people to be surprised, but they're designed almost to create the illusion that the two guys are both present at the same time. It's just a little piece of dramatic trickery.
No. You know, this in many ways is how to describe it. It's like you're reviving the reputation of Louis Armstrong.
And yes.
I wanted to play a little bit of a piece of music that Armstrong, the character, references in this play, discussing really just the enormity of his musical contribution from the very beginning. The song is West End Blues, and he takes great pride in it for obvious reasons. It is my iPhone cell phone ringtone.
Oh, really?
It
oh,
is.
Wonderful.
But,
that's
you know, it would horrify Armstrong to know it's Dizzy Gillespie's version.
Oh, no! Change it. Change it as
I'm
of today.
I'm going to have to change it. But here, let's play a little bit for...
At least it wasn't Charlie Barnett's version.
For the audience. So Terry, tell us about this song. What are we hearing here? What was so revolutionary when it came out?
Well, to begin with, the song opens, not that we didn't hear it, but it opens with an unaccompanied trumpet cadenza, which is like an explosion of virtuosity far beyond anything that had ever gotten onto a record with jazz.
It's like he wrote the book on trumpet.
That's right, and it all just flows out of that. And then he comes on and does a scat singing chorus, a duet. And the purpose of that, I think, is to show that he can, because back then, although other people had scatted before him, the idea that somebody could be both a very great instrumental soloist, a culture-changing instrumentalist, and also the same thing as a vocalist. Unprecedented. Hmm. Unprecedented. Not just in jazz, but in any kind of music. And also, to me, West End Blues embodies something that I think is central to Armstrong, which is I call him a major key artist, a fundamentally optimistic artist, not naive, never naive. He understands how bad the world is, how bad the world is for black people around the turn of the century.
He's lived it.
Right. He grew up in Storyville, but he never turns his face from it. But he transfigures his experience through this fundamental sense of optimism. And I think you hear that in West End Blues.
Oh, man, just even hearing that clip, I mean, you just go soaring on that trumpet. It's like he lifts you up into the air. Mm-hmm. You have wings if you didn't have it before.
Well said.
I, you know, I kind of wonder from your understanding, from writing the book, from listening to all of these original source materials, did Glazer know he was dealing with a musical genius, or did he just think, this guy's pretty good?
Glazer knew he was dealing with a genius. I actually make him say that in the play.
Yeah.
Not that that was the most important thing to him. Joe Glazer was in the money business. But on the other hand, in his paternalistic way, he loved this man. And that's the complexity and the tragedy of the play. These two guys really love each other, but they're loving each other over a canyon.
Yeah.
And John, in performing them, tries to show you just how wide that canyon is.
Yeah. You know, I always felt that it certainly feels to me, and even from my own research, that Glazer was very well aware of Armstrong's talents. And having first, as Terry says, he put in the play, having first witnessed his playing, he kind of knew. It's as if he saw the future, and it was going to be led by this individual as far as jazz music. You know, but he kind of got him into some other things like singing songs, a little bit more of a commercial.
More onstage pattern.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff, which the play deals with as what was his legacy? What were the choices that were made? Were they the best choices? Could they have been different? Should he have listened? Should he have forged his own path with someone else? And ultimately, Glazer made his name a household name.
In that market context, Louis Armstrong, a household name.
Yeah. So how much do you take away from that? But the play really deals with the questions of artistic genius and legacy and how we feel about what we're leaving behind or what we're going to leave behind.
Yeah, very much so.
Let's listen to another song. I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues.
This is my favorite Louis Armstrong trumpet solo. It was recorded in 1933. It's the last chorus of a famous standard song by Harold Arlen, who was the most profoundly jazz influenced of the great American songwriters. And Armstrong is fascinated by grand opera. He really was. I mean, he was collecting opera records when he was a boy in Storyville. And in this performance, I hear transmuted into the language of jazz the sound of a great opera singer who has somehow become a jazz musician.
Let's hear a little bit of that now. Had more time, we could just play the whole song.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's beautiful.
I also want to say, I mean, it just seems like if you're a trumpet player, you start with this is the Bible. This is everything is in conversation against this.
Yeah. What, all right, John? What is it that Miles says in the top of his first speech about there's nothing you can't play?
Nothing you can't play about Lewis. Now you caught me.
Nothing you can't play that Lewis hasn't already played
before.
Yeah. Just a phenomenal talent. And it's one that evolved over the course of his career.
Yes.
And, you know, the play gets into this, and we'll continue talking about this through the hour, but black audiences didn't follow him through the rest of his career. They kind of fell away.
I mean, they certainly, obviously, they followed him in the very beginning of his career. And I think what happened to Armstrong certainly happened to other jazz musicians, right? So it just kind of outstretched economically, ticket prices, whatever the case may be. But in the play, this play tries to certainly convey the effect that that had on Armstrong of losing his black audience and how that actually happened over the course of time. But it also happened to, as I said earlier, to many other jazz musicians. But it was of particular interest to Armstrong, and from my own research, and I remember watching a video about Lucille, his wife, and she was talking about her husband. He had already passed on. And she said, you know, one of the things that really cut him to the quick was the loss of his black audience and being labeled Uncle Tom.
Right. There's
because
this wonderful,
He had been a culture-changing black cultural hero in the 20s, 30s, 40s. And then suddenly the caravan moves on, and there he is. And suddenly he's old-fashioned. He's got Miles Davis talking very sharply and dizzy about how he was old hat in terms of his way of presentation. He couldn't understand that. He knew what he'd done both as an artist and as a man, and he couldn't understand why they would say such things about him.
Yeah,
it's tragic.
He was devastated by it. And, you know, oddly enough, that's where people of my generation kind of pick up Armstrong actually on his way down and certainly out of the sights of many people who are going to see or listen to jazz music. And then we pick up people like Miles Davis and Coltrane because they seem to be the young lions moving the music not only forward but also taking a very strong stance as it relates to racial politics.
And so that's why I put Davis into the play as a character and why he says what he says. Miles Davis really did say these things or things like them about Louis Armstrong, but he's
things like what?
Well, that Armstrong was an Uncle Tom, that he, you know, jumped around to amuse the white people.
Right.
But he is also speaking as a kind of Greek chorus who represents the attitudes of a new generation of blacks, more politically conscious, and the attitudes that hurt Armstrong, who couldn't understand where they were coming from.
Yeah, it was kind of like a changing of the guard in a sense. And Armstrong was really miffed at why he was being left behind or being termed this kind of an individual when he did so much to help those up-and-coming artists within the context of their careers.
You know, they stood on his shoulders.
They absolutely stood on his shoulders.
Okay. Not just music. He talks a lot about – I have him talk in the play about things that most people don't know, that he was the first black person to receive above the title star billing in a Hollywood film. The first one to host his own radio show, first one to be able to stay in hotels that had previously been closed to blacks.
We have a lot to talk about in the second half hour, and we want the audience to join in. You're listening to Stardust Memories, by the way. Some of you will recognize it. We're talking about Satchmo at the Waldorf, a one-man play at ACT's Geary Theater in San Francisco, and we have John Douglas Thompson and Terry Teachout in studio. What questions do you have for them? Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Tweet to us at KQED Forum. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
My start of melody, oh memory, oh memory, oh memory.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. We're talking about Louis Armstrong, his music, his politics, his life. We're listening to Potato Head Blues. And we have here in studio with us John Douglas Thompson, star of Satchmo at the Waldorf, playing at the ACT, and the playwright, Terry Teachout, here in studio.
And we just found out that we have in studio with us somebody who has an even more direct connection to the world of popular music that we've been talking about.
Oh, goodness
Fess
gracious.
Up, Rachel.
All right. Well, my great-grandfather was Irving Mills, who was the impresario at the Cotton Club in New York.
Wow.
And, brought the world Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, Lena Horne.
Figures very prominently in my next book, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington.
There you go. I hopefully I'll be brought in to interview you about
that.
Yeah. Well, you know, And it, that kind of gets at this comfortable, uncomfortable collaboration between so many black jazz musicians and so many Jewish managers who both love the music and love the artists, but were also taking advantage, capitalizing. I mean, they made each other rich, but it wasn't always a pleasant experience.
Well, the Armstrong and Glazer characters in the play both talk about this very explicitly, and what they say is rooted in truth. I mean, Armstrong says flat out, you had to get you a white manager if you were a black musician and you wanted to get somewhere back in the 20s, back in the 30s. You did, or you weren't getting through the front door. And Glazer was known in the business as a guy. Well, what I make him say is, you know, he was a man of his word. You just had to know what his word was. But he was, I think, quite fair to Armstrong in the terms of the period. Mm. Now, there is a huge reveal in this play, which I will tell you nothing about, on which the play hinges and which relates to what we are talking about now. But the big picture is that Armstrong trusted Glazer and had reason to, in the context of the 30s and 40s.
And the nature of their relationship was quite unique. Glazer did a lot of things over, above, and beyond that a manager would have done for a client, which we also talk about in the play. So there's a kind of ambiguity there in the sense who took advantage of who, you know, as I look at it. And hopefully in the presentation of it, the audience can walk away and say, you know, well, there are some pros and cons to this relationship.
Right.
But what we're trying to portray is the complexity, how complex, just from the outset of looking at this African-American musician and this Jewish manager who happened to be tied into the mob. And they remain in a 40-year relationship without a contract. There's no signed contract. It's just their words with each other.
And
you
this,
don't work with somebody for
40 years
if you don't believe.
Yeah. You don't have some.
If you don't trust them, if you don't like them, if you don't love them, obviously have some issues because a 40-year relationship is, let's face it, a 40-year relationship.
Right. It's a marriage.
Yeah, it's a, and sometimes
that
a very,
lasted longer than his.
That lasted longer than most marriages.
Marriages.
Yeah,
that's
but
right.
You know, one of the big themes in this is the way we sort of lose perspective. You know, it was such an overtly racist milieu that Armstrong came up in. He needed a go-between, a Jewish go-between, to reach the whites who were controlling not just, you know, the means of distribution, but, you know, the mob. We forget the mob controlled. And there were many mobs,
jazz music,
many mafias. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there were violent men that had to be catered to in order to be able to perform music in those days.
One of the things I found out in working on this book, and I got some of this into the play, is that black jazz musicians in Chicago in the 20s liked Al Capone. They all did, and they all talk about it, because he treated them fairly and was, within the context of what they were doing, a man of his word. And the phrase that the real-life Armstrong actually uses, I think somewhere in the play, is that he dug colored people.
Yeah.
And that's not a small thing. So their point of view on a guy like Capone relates to how they dealt with him, not what we know about him today.
With the distance of history.
Yeah.
But obviously these mobsters ran the clubs in New York and Chicago and certainly in other major metropolitan areas. And if you wanted to play, you know, you had to do certain things to get the opportunity to play in front of an audience.
And so to maintain the opportunity.
And to begin and to have a career, which is the trade-off. You know, is it Faustian that Glazer and Armstrong make together, that Armstrong makes with Glazer? Who knows? I mean, but at that time, many other jazz musicians kind of had that kind of a relationship.
Yeah. There weren't many clean hands in the music business back then.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a lot of calls coming in. I do want to get to them. But John, would you be willing to give us a little taste of what you do on stage?
Okay.
Well, I'm going to set this up for John. This is... I mentioned a little earlier that everybody always asked me on book tours, why do you say Lewis? And I thought, okay, I'll answer that one for all time by putting it into the play. So this is actually how Armstrong explains to the audience why he calls himself Lewis.
That's why I call myself Lewis. not Louis. Mr. Glazer, he called me Louis. White folks, they all call me Louis. The announcer here, he called me Louis every night before the show. That's okay. Call me what you want. But I ain't no goddamn Frenchman, ain't no Creole, ain't no Louis. I'm black. Black as spade flush. Woke up black this morning, black when I go to bed, still gonna be black when I get up tomorrow. Don't like it? You can kiss my black ass.
Boy, does that get a laugh.
It's one of the wonderful qualities of this show that you really feel like he is just hanging out with you in the audience and not censoring himself in any way.
No, I imagine the audience as being one person who is sitting downstage center. In the dressing room.
In the dressing room.
Listening to John.
That he comes in and has a conversation. Now, the funny thing about it, and as Terry will say, and as Terry was probably the first journalist to listen to those audio tapes that we're talking about, you get the sense when I was exposed to them, I had no idea what I was in for. But you get a much different Armstrong than the public persona that you'd see on television.
That's right.
You get a very raw personality who has very specific and strong ideas and is really speaking off the cuff because he taped conversations, interviews, parties, shows of his own, you know, to work on his music. So he taped pretty much everything as if he pressed the play record and just let it rip.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And
but from that, I got the conversational aspect of how Armstrong is in front of people and what he's willing to say.
And he kept the tapes.
Yeah.
He made sure that the tape survived. And so years later, there's a funny tape that I always like to talk about because we don't use it in the play, where it's a tape of Armstrong in a hotel room with Lucille, his last wife, and it's 3 a.m. I don't know when it is. He's trying to get her into bed. And she's not really interested in that at 3 a.m. And he says to her, it's your duty as a wife to keep the horn percolating. And that amuses her even less. And then suddenly there's a pause and you realize she has just looked around and seen the tape recorder. It's running. He says to her, or she says to him, you've got to erase that. She says in language that I won't use on your radio show. His response is, I can't do that. This is for posterity.
Mm. And that was the first. I remember Terry was very excited to bring me to listen to that particular section of audio. And that really changed that. I don't know. What is that? Maybe a 4 or 5 minute less than that excerpt.
Yeah.
That really shifted me about Armstrong in that one particular moment. And then I listen to more and more and you get...
It's a time machine.
Yeah.
He just comes right out of the past and
he's
in the room with you. And I remember when I first listened to that tape at the Armstrong Archives, suddenly I'm thinking, he means me.
Mm.
I'm the agent of posterity. I'm the first scholar to hear this tape. He was waiting for people like me because he knew what he was. He knew that he was... Armstrong was not an immodest man, but he knew what he had done, and that's why he kept these things.
And it gave me this insight into him as a private man. I mean, one of the big things certainly that I love about the play and certainly like to bring to audiences is, you know, the man behind the horn. Who is Louis Armstrong? And I feel those tapes kind of gave me that insight, and it really brought me to a place where, okay, I see where Terry's going with the play. I see where it's all coming from. I can now my job is to try to act this.
Let's go to the phones now because I want to give our listeners a chance to weigh in. Dave in Castro Valley.
Hi. I'm really enjoying this program because for one reason, I'm a trumpet player myself. And, you know, what you're saying about Louis Armstrong is great. He left a great legacy. He was one of the greatest trumpet players ever. Great tone quality, great range, and his feeling was just really for real.
Yeah.
I think as a trumpet player, I've talked with people about this, you know, a number of times. There was still a lot to be desired in his technical ability to do what has been done after him.
Right. He was a homemade player.
The first person to come along to do more was Dizzy Gillespie, you know, in terms of the speed that he played at, negotiating faster passages with bigger intervals and playing more harmonic chord structures. And, you know, you could make the argument for Louis Armstrong that, you know, he didn't do that because he really didn't understand that music, and he didn't really like it that much. At one point, you know, he talked about Coltrane as saying, you know, I don't know why these people have to play so many notes like that and so fast.
I tell you what, though, he listened to it. Yeah. We have the entire contents of his record library in the Queen's College archives. And so I know what he listened to. And he was listening to Monk, Thelonious Monk. He was listening to Stan Kenton, believe it or not. He was very conscious of what Diz recorded. I mean, he thought that bebop got a little bit too far ahead of the audience. But he was quite aware of what was happening in music, and he was fascinated by and up to a point open to it, I think.
And, you know, here's kind of my theory on that. I also think the way that Glazer managed him kind of cut out some of those really wonderful opportunities for Armstrong to have gone in some other directions. And I also think Armstrong—
You think he would have gone if he was on his own?
Yeah, and I think maybe Armstrong maybe felt that a little bit. But the relationship with Glazer was very comfortable and I certainly think lucrative, and he was willing to make those choices. And that's what we talk about in the play. Were those the right choices to strictly
go
commercial?
Well, that brings up this question of Hello, Dolly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it was the great hit of the last part. It was the great hit of his entire life, just in terms of sheer record sales. He knocked the Beatles off the number one slot in the charts. The last jazz musician ever to do that in the history of American popular music.
Yeah. Never again, huh?
Never again. And golly.
That was an amazing thing.
I mean, it's a fun record, you know. It's just all it is his band. There's a little bit of a string section dubbed on, but it's basically Louis Armstrong singing, playing trumpet, and it's a lovely record. It's great
fun. I could do it from memory, but I don't want to do that to our listeners. Why don't we hear it from Armstrong himself?
Yeah.
Hello, Dolly. This is Louis. Dolly, it's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly. I can tell, Dolly. You still growing, you still growing, you still going strong. I feel the room sway while the band's playing one of our old favorite songs from way back when. So take a rap, fellas, find an empty lap, fellas. Dolly, never go away again.
So how did Armstrong feel about this music? I mean, he does a lovely job.
Well, okay. I actually know the answer to that. And it's in the play.
Yes.
Glazer told Armstrong to record this song. When he did that, Hello, Dolly had not yet gotten to Broadway. It was still being tested out on the road. And somebody gave Glazer a demo of the song and said, would you make a record of it? So Armstrong listened to it. And he didn't really like the song. I mean, he just thought it was kind of a nothing song. But he did. You know, Glazer was the guy who knew what to do. So he recorded the song. And they go out on the road. And suddenly, this song becomes a hit in advance of the opening of the show. But Armstrong's forgotten that he recorded it. He doesn't remember the song at all. So we have a scene in the play which sort of shows how that played out over the next couple of weeks. And but no, I mean, for Armstrong, look, if you're an entertainer and you record a song that becomes a monster hit, no matter what you think of the song, you're glad that that the gods of music gave you that record.
Yeah.
You're not complaining.
Any thoughts on that, John?
It was the song. It's the song that everybody knows Louis Armstrong through. I've asked people just out on the street, what do you know about Hello, Dolly or The Wonderful World?
Right.
So in a sense, it brought him a particular kind of fame, which is what he, you know, it's part of the legacy that he questions, because it wasn't necessarily a song that he loved. And he talks about that, but it did bring him great fame, and I think he respects that aspect of it.
That's right.
Who wouldn't? I mean, you know, like, what musician doesn't want to top the charts?
I mean, I don't think – I think Armstrong, you know, to answer even the previous question, had the technical abilities to do what you would say a Dizzy Gillespie would do. I just don't think, as I said earlier, Glazer moved him more towards a Hello Dolly kind of a thing versus getting together with some of those other artists, which other producers wanted to do.
Right.
But I think Glazer had the purse strings on that and wouldn't allow that to happen.
Yeah, Armstrong's, the second half of his career is in one sense a set of unrealized possibilities.
Yeah.
I believe, for example, that had he been white instead of black, he could have become – he could have done dramatic film roles in exactly the same way that Frank Sinatra did. But those because he was extremely talented in front of the camera, but those opportunities were not open to him. Mm. He could have explored more adventurous musical possibilities in the last 10 or 15 years of his life, and that didn't happen because of Glazer. Yeah. On the other hand, I think we're all really glad that we have what we have from the later years. Who would not want to have What a Wonderful World?
Right.
You know.
Let's get another call in. We've got Casey in Berkeley.
Yes. I'd just like to say that I had the pleasure of meeting him many times because I worked at Jimbo's Bop City in San Francisco.
You lucky person, you.
Well, I put myself through art school doing that. And he was a lovely man, wonderful manners, and he often, not always, but he brought his wife several times, whom he seemed to love dearly. And she was really wonderful. But the thing that I wanted to ask you about was, I was under the impression that he had another wife that was a musician and did kind of, shall we say, racy songs. An earlier wife that was in her own right, a musician.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Is that true? The other thing is, I want to just make a comment, and I don't want to go off onto Miles, but I worked at Jazz Workshop also, and I saw Miles more times than I can count. And he was criticized everybody all the time in front of people. He was rude and, you know, love him if you like. But the fact that he said that about him, he said it nasty things about everybody. So just charted off to Miles.
Well, as for Armstrong's wives, I'll give it to John, who we have a bit in the play about that.
Yeah, I say I had four wives, a whore, a piano player, and two chorus girls. Count them. Four. Finally got it right that last time with Lucia, which is the wife that you're talking about that you saw.
That was the second wife was Lil Hardin, who plays piano on the Hot 5 recordings and was a pretty good musician and was enormously ambitious for Armstrong. She actually pushed him out of the nest.
Yeah.
And insisted that he follow his powers as a solo artist. So she was quite important in his life.
Thank you so much, Casey, for those wonderful memories. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's move on now to Dave in San Francisco. Hi, Dave.
Hi there. I had a question about a legendary story that I heard about.
And I bet I know what it is, so go ahead and ask.
And I can't remember where I saw this or read this, but that that Richard Nixon was a fan, and that Louis Armstrong was trying to carry a suitcase of marijuana across borders, and Nixon saw him at the airport and, you know, said, "I'm a big fan. Let me carry your bags for you." Does that ring a bell? Or
I deeply regret to tell you that this wonderful story is not true.
Aww.
We have actually, but I'll tell you one
that
was
so juicy.
I know, but I'll tell you
many
one that
possibilities.
Was. There's a famous Armstrong album from '56 called Ambassador Satch, and it shows Armstrong in morning dress. You know what you wear for an audience with the Queen. And he is holding what diplomats call a dispatch case. So he look. I mean, I think he has an umbrella too. So he's looking like an ambassador. Well, Armstrong himself said that on his way to the photo shoot, he stopped by his connection in Harlem and stocked up with marijuana. So by the time he gets to the photo shoot, that bag was full of grass. And that one is a true story. That one's true.
That's great.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, he pushed boundaries more than people realize.
You know? Yeah, with the pot. Yeah.
He was a daily communicant of the Church of Marijuana.
Indeed, you know. On a slightly more serious note, people forget that he publicly denounced President Eisenhower for dragging his feet on school desegregation in Little Rock, Arkansas. I love that that episode is revived.
In the show.
It's a
really nice episode in the play as Armstrong's trying to certainly in a section defend the things that he did within the civil rights movement. Some may be under the radar, but here's something kind of a thing, because a lot of people never attributed civil rights and the movement of that with Armstrong. And so it's a big, big thing. That's a big, big thing that he did. And we play that in the play. With the audience.
It becomes one of the big scenes in the play, and it's there to teach, it's there to get a laugh, it's there to tell you, you know, if you think that Louis Armstrong is an Uncle Tom, listen to this.
Right.
Al writes, most people who love Armstrong either don't know or remember one of the most innovative elements of jazz vocals was scat.
Yes.
The legend goes that Armstrong would forget the next lyric, so he filled it using his voice as a musical instrument. Ella Fitzgerald, Dizzy Gillespie, and so many others took and made it as much a part of jazz as the saxophone, piano, etc.
Well said. And Armstrong's own version of how this happened was in 1925. He was in the studio recording a song called Heebie Jeebies, and he dropped the lyric sheet during the recording, while the recording was being made. So he had always been singing scat, you know, since he was a kid down in New Orleans. So he just makes it up as he goes along, and they left it in the record. And that, for most people, that was the beginning of scat.
What a wonderful thing was born.
Yes.
Let's go to Susan in Alameda.
Thanks for taking the call, and thank you for Hello, Dolly. That dropped me right back into my suburban Long Island 1950s.
And my childhood in Southeast Missouri, yes.
Yes, where that was one of the five albums that my parents actually owned and raised us on. So thank you. I also want to thank John, whose career I've been following as a fellow Lemoyne College alumna.
Hello from Lemoyne.
Alumni Magazine, and I'm so excited to be able to see you in San Francisco. And my question to probably both of you, but I'm particularly interested in this from John. I can barely imagine you performing in the little firehouse on the Lemoyne College campus, but perhaps that did really happen. What was the most surprising and what was the most challenging part of working with this material? Was there anything that really surprised you or really was a challenge for you?
Well, on both parts of your question. First, it's great to hear from another Lemoyne grad.
Go Dolphins!
Go Dolphins out here on the West Coast. I would say that obviously what was really revealing to me was Armstrong's life, because it's just a lot of stuff that I didn't know. And I think most of the audiences that come, they don't know either. So it's quite enlightening. But what was really difficult or really challenging was actually doing this. It's a one-person show. So doing the one-person show, playing three characters, the memorization that's necessary, I find doing this show to probably be the hardest thing that I've ever done. Out of all the classical plays I've done, out of all the Shakespeare, you know, I just did Tamburlaine like about 6 months ago. And this is harder in the sense that there are more lines, there are more technical challenges. Also, I find it emotionally, physically, and mentally incredibly rigorous and draining.
It's quite a thing to see him after a performance. He looks like he just ran a marathon.
Yeah, but then the other aspect of it was, as an actor, and I think a lot of actors out there feel this way, they wanted to do a one-person show, because it teaches you so much about the craft of acting. And so you want to kind of get one under your belt. And trust me, I would not do another one. But this one, you know, because I have this somewhat under my belt, I wouldn't take on a new one, because it's very difficult. And it's also the other aspect of it, when we were rehearsing, it's a very lonely, On one hand, it's a really lonely process because it's just you up there. But on the other hand, it's an incredibly rewarding process because it's so collaborative. So as me, Terry, and Gordon Edelstein in the room working on this play, and we all worked with each other and,
that's right.
And traded hats, if you will. I'd suggest something to Terry. Terry would suggest something to me or to Gordon or vice versa. And we'd all quite create this play in a sense together. So in that sense, I never felt that level of collaboration. We'd always talked about it in drama school, but I'd never really felt it. And working on this piece did that for me.
I really saw the process as trying – like fitting a bespoke suit on John. I wanted every line to lay on his tongue to be comfortable. If and whatever he said, I think this will work better, I'd say, let's try it. Yeah. I mean, I was up for whatever came out of him. And wonderful, wonderful things came out of him.
And, you know, I would say the biggest reward for me is obviously working with wonderful artists like Terry and Gordon. But even more so is what I learned about Armstrong. His story is quite amazing. And now I also feel that, like, it does need to be resurrected because too many people don't know or
new
either they've forgotten.
Need
or
right.
Generation
yeah.
needs
yeah.
to. My own generation, I'm 52. My generation certainly needs to hear this story. Generations younger than mine, obviously, and generations older.
Well, gentlemen, what a pleasure it's been talking with you both. Terry Teachout, playwright and arts blogger extraordinaire, John Douglas Thompson, star of Satchmo at the Waldorf, which runs through February 7th at ACT in San Francisco. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.